I want to describe someone to you this morning. A married guy. Been married over 20 years. He's a good provider. Steady job. Has provided for the needs of his family all these years. He has multiple children. At least from the outside, looks like they're pretty well, healed. Quality kids, we would say. He's got a good reputation. People like him. If you were to kind of take a poll of people that know him in various settings in the neighborhood or at his job or even in his church, they would say to you, you know, he's a good guy. Speaking of church, he's a regular church attender, been involved in leadership off and on over the years in his church. He's just the kind of guy that you go, wow, I like him. He's got a lot going. He's kind of a picture of virtue, we would say. Good guy. Did I mention he has a pornography problem? Don't think I did. That change anybody's view of this man I'm describing to you? Now, let me ask you a question. How would you counsel his wife, who knows all the accolades that I've just described about him, but has just learned of this dark side that's been true of his life for quite a while? How would you counsel her? Hey, look, you got mostly good? Would your counsel be something sort of dismissive of that dark thing? Because after all, look at the kind of qualities he's got, the attributes. Or would your counsel be more on the other side that says, you know what, I don't care how long the list of attributes gets. This is this isn't just a blowout, this is a car going off a cliff. I'm not describing anybody I know. But in one sense, I'm describing lots and lots of people I know. When a person comes to Jesus and has his or her sins forgiven, the Bible describes that event as a new life has begun. You could check it out in John chapter 3. Born again, a new life has begun. And God calls that person to a daily walk with him. Unfortunately, the daily walk piece has become optional to many in the church in the Western world today. Stay with me. Truth be told, it's more than unfortunate. I believe it's heresy. To think that someone can come to Jesus and there's no outcome is something that's completely foreign to the Bible. Consider these words from Dallas Willard, who's a professor of philosophy at a university in Southern Cal and a very devout follower of Jesus Christ. He writes, "First, there is absolutely nothing in what Jesus himself or his early followers taught that suggests you can decide just to enjoy forgiveness at Jesus' expense and have nothing more to do with him. There's nothing in what Jesus taught or his early followers taught that suggests, sure, sign me up, give me the forgiveness, but I don't want a whole lot more to do with him. However, many people practice that very thing, even some in our gathering, hearing my words this morning. Jesus calls individuals with two simple words. He still does, and he always has. Do you know those two words? Follow me. That's what Jesus said. First place, Mark 1, 16 to 20. He says it to two sets of brothers. Simon and Andrew, James and John. All four fishermen, all four at Galilee. Jesus points to them, you two, James and John. Andrew, Peter, come here. Simon, come here. I want you to follow me. And many in those days and since have dropped what they were doing and followed him. And they have begun to walk with Jesus Christ. And when you think about walking, I want you to just imagine it with me a little bit. What is walking with someone? What's it look like? You probably don't walk with someone you don't like, unless you have to. You know, my mother said, take your sister's hand. You know, I was doing it, you know, physically, but in my heart I wasn't, you know, kind of thing. You usually walk with somebody you like, right? Usually it's someone that your cadence is similar to. In fact, there's a couple that's on a walking trail by our house. It's where people stroll and some walk, some of us jog like gazelles, you know. And there's a lot of horsing around. There's kids playing, play areas and stuff along the way. And every morning, Debbie's actually stopped to get to visiting with these people. Comes a couple, probably in their 70s, I'm guessing. And it turns out they love Jesus. But along the way, Debbie's gotten to know a little bit about them. But the feature that you can identify without knowing them at all is every single day that they walk, they wear matching shirts. It's great. I mean, like, he was a Navy guy from Annapolis. And it's really cool. They always match. Maybe that happens over time. You walk with somebody you like and you start to dress like them. You know, you look like them. For a Christ follower, the relationship that was begun when you heard him and saw him point to you, follow me, is best described as a walk. Come, Jesus says to you, come walk with me. He didn't take them to school, he took them along the way and schooled them as they went. That's what the 3 years was about. And on a daily basis, you and I face choices that have to do with how we will walk with him. That's what this talk's about this morning. How's your walk? Years ago, a college student stopped me in my tracks. I've had a lot of college students in my life over the years, and they've said some things to me that have just really rung the bell. You know that time when you're talking to somebody, and then they say something, and you're like, what? You know? This college student, out of absolutely nowhere, there was no pretext for this. We didn't have a conversation going, and I finally got to this question. He simply walked straight up to me like I am to Roger and said, hey, Pastor Steve, how's your walk? And I looked at him and went, for sure? You for real? How's my walk? Does my face look a little irritated right now? Certainly surprised, like, what? I thought, you little snot, why don't you pay attention to your own life, you know? Why do you need to be bothered about my life? Maybe some of you feel that from time to time when the person standing up here is getting close to home. But I stayed with it for a second, and for a while I wanted to dismiss it completely. Like, why don't you, you know, talk to somebody else? I'm sure others have a much more interesting answer to the question, how's your walk? And I thought, you know what, I still wasn't done with it. I thought, you know, you're not my mother. I don't have to answer that question, you know. And then the Lord said, no, but you're a pastor. How's your walk? Great question. I'm supposed to be walking with Jesus, so the right question is, say it with me, how's your walk? So let's spend some time on that this morning. And if in spending time there, you find out my walk's off. Some area, some way, in some measure, then the second part of this message is for you. Well, the first one's important too. Let's spend some time. Luke chapter 6, where my Bible is open to. I'd like you to turn there. Page, 730. Luke chapter 6. Jesus calls you and I into a relationship with Him. And when He does, let me just say something that may be unclear to you at this point. He calls you into a relationship with Him, and there are certain expectations attached. Okay? Jesus has expectations of you and of me and this relationship He's offering to us. Luke chapter 6, I want you to see with your own eyes an assumption that Jesus makes. It begins in verse 46. Why do you call me Lord, Lord, and do not do what I say? I will show you what He is like who comes to me and hears my words and puts them into practice, does what I say. He's like a man building a house who dug down deep and laid the foundation on bedrock. When a flood came, the torrent struck that house, but I love this, could not shake it, because it was well built. But the one who hears my words and does not put them into practice is like a man who built a house on the ground without a foundation. And the moment the torrent struck that house, it collapsed. And notice its destruction was complete. Let me give you a label for what you and I just read. He expects, when He invites you and I into this relationship with those simple two words, follow me, He expects you and I to obey. That's what it means to become an apprentice to Him, the Master. We do what He says we should do. We walk so closely with Him that in time we start to look like Him, and live like Him. That is not optional. He expects our obedience. Vance Havner said, you haven't really learned a commandment until you have obeyed it. He never commands, though, never commands us to do something that you aren't capable and I am not capable of doing and expected to do with His help. You never get God pulling stuff like that on us, playing tricks with us or games with us. He's not a gamer. He will simply tell you to do, and me as well, to do things that we are capable, and it is His assumption and expectation we will do. So He doesn't mess with us in that way, which explains the surprising tone of verse 46 when He says, why do you call me Lord, Lord, and don't do what I say? So with every command, what I'm saying here, comes the expectation of obedience. Do you see how that takes it up a notch? With every command Jesus makes, there's an expectation of obedience. Nothing clarifies doctrine like doing. Nothing. So let's give some examples. When He tells you, you can write these down, the references that is, and then check them out for yourself, okay? When he tells a husband to love his wife, and he does, Colossians 3, verse 19, that is not a suggestion. There's no option there. You, husband, I always personalize it. Steve, you are to love Debbie. Not an option. Verse 18, Colossians 3, is one to wives. Wives, you are to submit to your husbands. That is not negotiable. People, amazing. Simple statements like that, they look for all sorts of ways around it, or to soften it, or weaken it, or calibrate it somehow to a changing culture. No, no, no. Here's another one. When he tells us to flee sexual immorality, 1 Thessalonians, a lot of places. Let me give you 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, 1-8, or 1 Corinthians 6, verse 18. It's very straight up. Flee sexual immorality. When he gives that teaching to us, his assumption is that we can and we must flee. It's not a foregone conclusion that your chemistry is such that you falter more than others. No, not at all. There's no qualifier. There's absolutely no caveat given or exemption suggested. Flee sexual immorality means just that. Here's another one. When he tells us to forgive or we won't be forgiven. That's in Matthew 6, verses 14 and 15. The assumption is that there are no exceptions. Husbands, love your wives, Colossians 3, 19. Wives, submit to your husbands, Colossians 3, 18. Flee sexual immorality, 1 Corinthians 6, 18. And then this last one, forgive or you won't be forgiven, Matthew chapter 6, verses 14 to 15. Probably no statement has more effort been made to try to soften and explain our way around it than that highly conditional statement. Forgive others or you will not be forgiven. A.W. Tozer expressed great concern about the practice of some today where obedience has become optional. Brace yourself. He writes, a notable heresy has come into being throughout the evangelical Christian circles. It's the widely accepted concept that we humans can choose to accept Christ only because we need Him as Savior and that we have the right to postpone our obedience to Him as Lord as long as we want to. Nonsense, concludes Tozer. Salvation apart from obedience is unknown in the sacred scriptures. Whoa. Let's make something very clear. Romans 3:28 says there's absolutely no way you can earn your salvation. So please, let's get that right back in focus. This is not works salvation. No amount of good works can earn you salvation. None. It's a gift given freely. But every kind of good works can and should flow from salvation. We're going to baptize somebody in second service. One of the points I want to make to clarify is baptism does not result in salvation. Baptism, an act of obedience, results from salvation. You already have a relationship with Jesus. Baptism just simply makes it public. Good works don't result in salvation. Let's make that very clear. They are the result of salvation. So when Jesus asks, verse 46, very incredulously, why do you call me Lord, Lord, and you don't do what I say? If that's true of you this morning, a question. What's your explanation? If I had a way to somehow pull this from the page and say, you know something, let's forget the history of this. Let's forget that it was written a long, long time ago. And let's trade places with the one speaking it right now. And imagine Jesus looking at you. And if that's not true of you, you don't do what he says, but you call him Lord. What's your explanation? And here's a redemptive piece. What's the remedy? If that's you, and I suspect it's probably true of most of us at certain times. Not in every category. We, you know, if you saw the videotape of my life, you'd say, "Wow, he walks pretty well in lots of areas." There's evidence to suggest that obedience is something he takes seriously in his personal life. But if you kept scrolling the videotape of my life, you might go, "Wow, he kind of got upset back there." Or, if I didn't know better, that looks like he's holding a grudge there. So, what's the remedy if, in fact, you're one of those that says, "Lord, Lord," but don't do what he says to do in every way, every day? The rest of my message is for you if you're looking for a remedy. If you're saying, "What do I do with that?" He's Lord of you, but not in every area of your life. What are you supposed to do about that? Like the man I told you about at the start of this message? Let me give it to you short and then look at a scripture together. Straighten out your walk. I asked the question, "How's your walk?" Here's the, "What do I do if it's out of alignment?" You got to straighten out your walk. So here's how it looks. Let me ask you a question. If Jesus Christ were to return today, what area of your life is, I don't know if it's got a sign, but it may as well have a sign that says "out of order"? That's a very personal question for you to ask. What room, think of it as your house, your life is like a house. What room or what closet of your life is sort of taped shut? It's locked. What is it that you're thinking about right now? I made a list of some things. Is it your language? Is it your sexual behavior? Is it your unwillingness to forgive? Some call that bitterness. Ephesians 4, 31 and 2 call it bitterness there. Is it certain personal habits like movies you watch or TV shows or the music you listen to? Is it thoughts or attitudes where some straightening is called for? You could say, if you were honest, you could say, "You know, that's kind of out of order." And along with that sign, you might say, "And off limits." Okay, so just think about that right now. And let me show you someone who knew how to straighten out his walk. In fact, if I had you write down on a piece of paper right now, maybe some of you want to do this, the name of somebody that would be on your short list of cool dudes in the Bible, I'll bet many of us would mention David, King David. All right? We can go into a lot of reasons why, but he would be on the list of standout guys. Psalm 139 gives us at least one reason why he's quite a guy. Check it out, would you? Psalm 139, page 445, if you'll just take some time to turn there. In fact, I think you're going to see here, it would be a great thing. You could do a lot worse than to follow David's example. I would say to you, follow David's example. Why would I say that? Simply this. David messed up big time. Committed adultery and then murdered to cover his tracks. Let's agree, big stuff. Huge. All right, he did all of that, and he did it right in front of God. And then And I think this is why he gets the status, man after my own heart. If you ask God, God, hey, you see the whole life of David. You saw him before he committed adultery and murder, and you know him after. You're still going to stick with the man after my own heart label when describing him? And I think the secret for why God would answer absolutely has to do not with his perfection. Because I doubt if most of us would have David on our list because, wow, guy that never messed up. I want to be like that guy. No. It was something else, wasn't it? How do you commit murder and adultery and not have two really black eyes? It must be something else. And Psalm 139, I think, is going to reveal. Well, then what was it? What was it that made David a very special person to God? Psalm 139 is David's understanding of God. He starts with a label. Let me give it to you, and you can write this one down. He describes God as all-knowing. There's nothing that God doesn't know. It's verses 1 to 6. Theologians call it omniscience, all-knowing. Okay? O Lord, you have searched me and you know me. You know when I sit and when I rise. You perceive my thoughts from afar. You discern my going out and my lying down. You're familiar with all of my ways. Before a word is on my tongue, you know completely all about it, Lord. You hem me in behind and before. You have laid your hand upon me. Such knowledge, let me paraphrase it, blows my mind. It's too wonderful for me, too lofty for me to attain. So you're all-knowing, God. You know what I'm going to say before I say it. You know what I'm going to think before I think it. So you get it. So that's the first description that David gives of God. He gets it. God is all-knowing, omniscient. Here's the second one that he gets into in verse 7 and following. He's always present. Then theologians again use the word omnipresent. So omniscient, all-knowing, omnipresent, everywhere present. Verse 7, where can I go from your spirit? Where can I flee from your presence? If I go to the heavens, you are there. If I make my bed in the depths, you are there. If I rise on the wings of the dawn, if I settle in the far side of the sea, even there, your hand will guide me. Your right hand will hold me fast. If I say, surely, in the darkness, it will hide me. And the light becomes night around me. Even the darkness will not be dark to you, and the night will shine like the day. For darkness is as light to you. Wow. So he's all-knowing. He knows everything. He's everywhere present. Okay, he's omnipresent. And then thirdly, and he begins this in the next verse and goes on for a little bit, describing how powerful God is. And he uses himself in his own creation, the creative work of God in fashioning David in his mother's womb to describe the all-powerful God. Again, theologians call it omnipotence. So he's omniscient, he knows everything. He's omnipresent, he's everywhere present. He's omnipotent, he's all-powerful. Verse 13, you created my inmost being. You knit me together in my mother's womb. I praise you because I'm fearfully and wonderfully made. Your works are wonderful. I know that full well. My frame was not hidden from you when I was made in the secret place. When I was woven together in the depths of the earth, your eyes saw my unformed body. All the days ordained for me were written in your book before one of them came to be. How precious to me are your thoughts, O God. How vast is the sum of them. Were I to count them, they would outnumber the grains of the sand. When I awake, I am still with you. Isn't that a great... Take this to your devotions tonight. God's got you on his mind. Isn't that reassuring in some cases? God's thinking about you all the time. His thoughts toward you outnumber the grains of the sand. It's all right there. So all of that gives David an impression of God. In our lives, God sees and God knows it all. Here's where that comes to hit me personally. That means that any measure, any attempt at spin that I might use to try to soften something I'm doing, get this, it fails to fool God, who sees it all, who knows it all, who was present for it all. God doesn't go, oh, wow, I wasn't there. I guess I'll have to check the videotape. I'll have to get some witnesses. He saw it all. He's not fooled by it. But when we engage with this kind of self-examination that David does at the end of Psalm 139, some incredible things happen. Look at verse 23. Some of you have already done so. Search me, he says, O God, and know my heart. Test me and know my anxious thoughts. See if there is any offensive way in me, and lead me in the way everlasting. God, I'm asking you to look inside the quietest, privatest place of all, my heart. I'm giving you invitation, God, to look inside my mind, my thoughts. I'm even giving you permission to look at my ways, my actions. Look at it all. What I feel, what I think, what I do. Look at it all. And if in doing so, you find something, verse 24, that's offensive, then I'm asking you, in showing me the closet, the corner of my life that needs attention, that needs cleaning, I'm asking you, God, to help me clean it. To help me clean it. People, His grace allows you to go there. In fact, His grace says you must go there. Have you gone there with God? Following David's example, when you open the door that's been locked, labeled off limits, out of order, to that area of your life that needs cleaning, needs straightening. If you have, you can tell the similar story that God, He will clean it out with your help. He will not do it just while you carry on your business. He will take you by the hand and with you clean out that closet. But He waits for you to open it, that's for sure. I want to be clear about something this morning before we close it. I was reading in Genesis chapter 1 about somebody that wants to have you make light of what you're hearing right now. I've never used this to describe the devil, but I think it's accurate. Satan is a minimizer. What do I mean by that? He is the one who will tend to want to help you and me soften the seriousness of an area, a closet, a corner, as I've described it this morning, that's out of order. In fact, he wants that husband I described earlier, and he wants the wife who learns those things about him, that area of his life. He wants them to soften it and vote for, wait, look at all the good going on in his life. Why are you getting so worked up about the one area? That's what the devil does. If you need proof of it, read Genesis chapter 3, 1-8 again, and you'll see exactly what I mean. He softened, he minimized the command, and he also minimized the consequences with Eve. And the result was sin entered the world and the human race fell. And he does the same thing today. To leave sin, listen to me, Leaving sin in some corner or closet of your life is to allow a corrosive to remain inside of you. It is toxic to you, to your soul. It doesn't just go away because you're not thinking about it. It doesn't go away because the sermon's finally over and whew, no more moments to think about that private area that's out of order. It's corrosive to your soul. That's why God's so interested in hearing you say, God, please reach into this area. It smells bad. It looks bad. It is bad. And help me clean it up. Because God knows the damage and destruction that will do to your soul. So how's your walk? How's your walk? Incredibly, as David discovered, God knows the answer to that question already. Isn't that amazing? God knows how He would answer it about my life. The question is, in truth and in honesty, does my assessment of my walk match His? And if it doesn't, am I willing in humility to say, God, I'll go with your view of me? I'd like you to bow your heads this morning. I am forever attracted to the image in Luke 18 of the two people that come into a gathering like this. One of them, very interested in facades, images. Very interested in externals, looking righteous. Looking like he had his act together, we would say. The other one came into the same setting and said, you know, God, I don't deserve to be here. Maybe that's you this morning. Maybe there's, if anything, you're tempted to stand up and say, Pastor, you're being way too nice. There isn't, it's not a closet. It's most of my house. If that's true of you today, you can leave here completely cleansed and set on a brand new course with Him. It starts by praying the prayer David showed us to pray. Search me, O God, and know my heart. Try me. Know my thoughts. Take a look at my ways. And if there's an area that's out of order in my life, I invite you to come into that area with me and help me get it clean completely. You need to spend a few moments with God as music plays. We're going to sing a last song. We're going to collect the morning offering. That's an expression of your love for Jesus. If it's for any other reason, don't give. Don't give. But if in loving Jesus it leads to obeying Him and giving, then give. He wants stuff that's much tougher to give than money. He wants hearts. Will you give Him yours today, freshly, in every way? And then will you pledge, starting today, to say, God, every day I want to pray, search me, clean me, make me wholly yours. So that when He asks you, how's your walk, you'll say, with you, Jesus, it's with you. Respond to Him this morning, would you?